say, I had no idea this information existed. And indeed, if it wasn't common knowledge or it wasn't made available to them, that might be a completely legitimate excuse. And that could be forgiven. But what if a broadcast like this, disseminating this information across the country and Washington, D.C. and New York and Los Angeles and other cities, establishing it through GaryNoll.com, which visited by have several million visits per month by individuals, going to my webpage for these kind of articles where this information is in detail, and where possible, publishing it in peer-reviewed journals itself, then it wouldn't be so easy for that person to say, not only did they not know, but they could not have known. Now, it doesn't mean that this broadcast or the dissemination of this information will ultimately reach everyone, but it does mean that if I could find this information, so could they. Now, I'm not a physician. I am a PhD in human nutrition and public health science, and have been an investigative journalist and a public health advocate for my entire career. But I have no more awareness of where to find these facts than the average physician, and possibly less so. So I've gone to their specialties, gone into their journals. So if I'm talking on a specific topic, I'm going to then narrow it primarily to an area, for instance, if it's surgery, that surgeons would become, should be aware of. I'm looking at their journals. If it's one on obstetrics, obstetric journals. On psychiatry, psychiatric journals. So it narrows the argument about what did they know, could they have known, and why didn't they know? So now we have hundreds of articles showing problems that are substantial and serious. I give that merely as background to the issue at hand because of people saying, I didn't know. I couldn't have known. Well, there might be reasonable to that argument. But if you are a specialist, if you're board certified in a given area, and if all the research showing what you're doing is wrong and dangerous comes from your given area, published in your specific journals, then it means you're not even paying attention to your own journals, keeping up with what's important. And that is a responsibility every physician has, to keep themselves aware at least in their area of specialization. And there's one other argument behind this particular program in this series, and that's the following. For years, every single effort by patients and by advocates, even by journalists or by physicians, to suggest that there was a non-toxic or non-invasive way of handling a problem that would either be adjunctive to or complementary to an orthodox approach was attacked. Attacked repeatedly. Attacked with such viciousness that the mere suggestion that an alternative approach such as chelation therapy for heart disease or possibly an elimination diet of getting rid of the dairy and sugar and meat for a person with arthritis, or possibly a cleansing program for someone who was suffering from fibromyalgia, that these were all quackery, that they had no basis in science, and that all of orthodox science is grounded in legitimate science and has been proven. Therefore, a journalist would be very reluctant to promote any concept or any theory or any herb or practice if, on the one hand, they were told, do you want to provide a forum for people who could be promoting something that is unscientific, unproven, actually disproven and quackery? Well, most journalists would think well and think, no, I'm not going to do something that would cause harm to people. And on the other hand, there has not been anyone examining the assumption that whatever orthodoxy does has been proven. The medications were given. The physician said, of course, hormone replacement therapy is proven. There's over 40,000 studies in the scientific literature on hormone replacement therapy. That is correct. There are over 40,000 studies, 99.9% sponsored by pharmaceutical companies who are trying to patent their particular type of hormone replacement therapy. But that doesn't prove it's safe. So I've simply asked this question. Are the procedures, including the drugs or the other procedures provided by your standard rank-and-file physician, are these safe and effective? And that is what led me to examine the literature. And once I began, which took over 8 years full-time, with tens of thousands of hours spent in this investigation, I discovered that, indeed, there was no body of evidence that showed that the average procedure, or any specific procedure, was guaranteed to be safe and effective. To the contrary, I have found in over 10,000 studies that I have and carefully reviewed that many of the procedures, including many of the common procedures that are offered, have never been proven safe and either are marginally or non-effective, and sometimes they're not even effective and deadly. But then the question is begged, if you find that a procedure is unsafe and non-effective, why would it be used? Surely there are medical oversights and FDA oversight committees. And then that led me into another area, the area of bias, the area of how much input the industry that is creating a particular drug has in getting it onto the market, keeping it there, advising the FDA. And then you start seeing the tail that wagged the dog. And then you start seeing how many people who've worked for the FDA in oversight positions go from that oversight of a drug to working for the very drug company that they were overseeing. And how many of them own stock? How many people are simply biased? They have a gross conflict of interest. Then you see, well, who do we trust then? If there's so many people who are so exposed to conflicts of interest, then how do we know that what we're being told to take or do is really in our best interest? And my answer would be, you don't. And hence we need truly an objective review, one that has no attachments to any political or economic or philosophical support for a paradigm that is in great need of revision, if not completely deconstruction and reconstructing one that is based upon quality science. And the interesting part of this is that the very people who were attacking all alternative therapy as non-scientific and non-beneficial are the ones practicing quackery in the name of orthodoxy. Let us begin our discussion. Today, we're going to examine in three parts, time permitting, the incidence of malnutrition. Now, why? Because we are told that the only people who should be advising us on what we should eat in a hospital are dietitians. In fact, of the some 65,000 dietitians in the United States, and I also have graduated from dietetic school, so I speak with some authority on this, they are the ones who, on a day-to-day level, along with a physician, determine the diet. No one is able to get a diet without a physician recommending it. The dietitian then has to make sure that the diet is implemented and does have input. But unfortunately, no one seems to be looking at the patient, and with deadly results. Let me go through this. I will cite the scientific journal. I will cite a brief quotes from the conclusions of the study. And as you will see, I'm not dealing with just a few. And I will go sometimes a little further into this than on other issues, because just to show you how dangerous it is, in this case, to assume that once you go into a hospital, you will be taken care of on all levels. From the Journal of the American Medical Association, volume 235, page 1567, an article entitled The Prevalence of Malnutrition in General Medical Patients. This study showed that the prevalence of malnutrition in 1 year in hospitalized patients of the general wards of an urban teaching hospital was 44% or greater. 34% of the patients had levels of malnutrition associated with reduced cellular immunity. Now, that's almost 50%. What's significant is that these were malnutrition cases that occurred in the hospital. From the British Medical Journal, volume 308, page 945. The incidence and recognition of malnutrition in hospital. Now, this study shows that 40% of patients admitted to an acute teaching hospital were malnourished, and in 78% of the nutritional status further deteriorated during the hospital stay. They got worse. In addition, two-thirds of all patients lost weight during hospital stay. From the Peer Review Journal Nutrition, this is January 1996, talking about malnutrition and poor outcome in critically ill patients. This study shows that 43% of 129 patients admitted to the intensive care unit of a hospital were malnourished. Length of hospital stay, complications, and the number of deaths were greater in malnourished compared to well-nourished patients. And malnourished patients with less severe illness were worse clinically in their outcomes than sicker, well-nourished patients. The study also showed that malnutrition in patients who underwent surgery developed mainly during their preoperative stay in general medicine wards were bad. So in lay language, what it means is you have two people going into a hospital. They both had the same illness, same level of acute infection. The one that is malnourished or more malnourished is the one least likely to survive, even if both other conditions are the same. So the status of a person's nutrition is extremely important. This comes from nursing nutrition in hospital, Peer Review Journal, volume 13, May to June 1998. The article's on in-hospital malnutrition, indications of postoperative evolution. This study shows that after admission to the hospital, the number of patients with below normal levels of serum albumin doubles, and the number of those with below normal levels of body weight and body mass index triples. Nutritional status worsens as length of hospital stay increases. And your albumin levels is one indicator of whether or not you're doing well or not doing well in your immune system. So right there you have a very important study done on a large database of patients in the hospital showing, hey, your immune system is going to take a big hit when you go into hospital. From the Journal of the American Medical Association, June 1999, page 2013. Protein energy undernutrition among elderly hospitalized patients, a prospective study. This study evaluated whether hospitalized patients receive adequate nutritional intake during hospital stay and whether eventual nutritional deficits translate in increased mortality rates, meaning death rates. Now, the results of this study conducted on 497 elderly patients during a four-year period showed that 21% of the patients consumed less than 50% of their estimated maintenance requirements. And this was partly due to the fact patients were frequently ordered to eat nothing but by mouth, but did not receive nutritional supplementations by any of their routes. Quite simply, they were being starved through negligence. Patients with low energy intake were 8 times more likely to die while being in the hospital. That's 800%. And 3 times more likely to die within 90 days compared to patients with a normal energy intake. Quote, these findings indicate that during their hospital stay, elderly patients often receive largely inadequate nutrient intake, a practice that seems associated with a significant impact on their overall survival. Unquote. And that's from the Journal of the American Medical Association, a recent article. Now, what's that mean? Let's just stop for a moment, put this in perspective. What that's telling us is that you have a very high chance of dying if you're an older patient going into a hospital because of the malnutrition that you'll receive once you're in the hospital. And this is at the very same time that there is a movement by dietitians to say we should be the only people by law in a given state allowed to give any information or advice on nutritional counseling to anyone. And that's actually been ratified in most states. More than half the states in the United States now have a dietitian's nutrition law on the books. And these individuals are the ones responsible for seeing that so many senior citizens die each year or suffer each year because of malnutrition that they contributed to from their gross negligence. So the question is, have we placed the least capable, the least qualified, the least educated, and the least sensitive to the issue people in a position of power over the nutritional status of a patient? Legislators, caveat emptor, beware. You have given the power to the people who are most responsible for killing and injuring the largest single number of people due to nutritional negligence in this country. How many? I've compiled statistics show that approximately 50,000 Americans are dying from malnutrition that they contracted from being in a hospital each year, with an additional 2 million additional hospital stays. That's an astronomical amount. Could you imagine if some drug was shown to cause 50,000 preventable deaths in a year? There'd be headlines. There'd be legislative hearings. There'd be a complete challenge to stopping that. And yet, year in and year out, year in and year out, the dietitians, poorly educated, unaware of what they're doing, and doctors completely ignorant of what they're doing when it comes to nutrition, are killing people and being rewarded for it. From the Journal of the American Dietetic Association, the official journal of dietitians, volume 96, page 361. An article, Malnutrition and Clinical Outcomes, the Case for Medical Nutritional Therapy. This article reports on the results of several studies conducted on over 1,327 patients, indicating that 40% to 55% of hospitalized patients are either malnourished or at risk for malnutrition, and 12% of them are severely malnourished. Postoperative complications and death occur three times more often, and hospital costs are 75% higher in malnourished compared to well-nourished patients. The American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, November 1997, the prevalence of malnutrition in non-surgical hospitalized patients and its association with disease complications. Now, the results of the study conducted on 155 patients admitted to the internal medicine ward of a hospital show that the prevalence of malnutrition in this cohort, according to the Maastricht Index, which evaluates ideal weight together with prealbumin, albumin, and lymphocyte levels, was 62%. Rates of complications were 300% higher in malnourished versus well-nourished patients. So what this means is that when you do not pay attention to a person's nutritional status, they're going to get worse. And then the complications start to occur. Now, a person ends up with severe complication. Pneumonia might be a complication. A person dies. It's not going to be on their death certificate they died of malnutrition or nutritional neglect. It's they died of pneumonia or the complications of some other disease. This comes from the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, volume 47, page 532. The article, The Relationship Between Clinical Assessment of Nutritional Status and Adverse Outcomes in Older Hospitalized Medical Patients. This study evaluated the nutritional status of 369 patients aged 70 years or more admitted to a general ward of a tertiary care hospital and found that 60% of them were well-nourished, 25% were moderately malnourished, and 16% were severely malnourished. After controlling for severity of disease, presence of coexisting diseases, and functional status on admission, the researchers showed that severely malnourished patients were 280% more likely to die and 320% more likely to be admitted to a nursing home within a year of discharge compared to well-nourished patients. Let me just show you the consequence of this. Let's say that your mom or dad or grandparents have a problem and it's decided that they should go into the hospital. But leading up to that problem, you didn't notice that they were incapable of handling themselves, being able to maintain a lifestyle where they were relatively self-sufficient. So they could stay at home and do whatever it was that they normally do on a daily basis. If they are given diets that are inadequate, if they develop malnutrition from being in this hospital, they have a high probability of within a year of so deteriorating that they cannot physically or even mentally frequently take care of themselves after that hospital experience. And therefore their whole life changes and they're sent into some form of assisted living or nursing home environment. And no one stops to say, well, how is it that a person could have been all right a year ago and now 6 months or 8 months later, they can't be? The assumption is, well, it's just old age. This article is showing, no, it's not just old age. Old age is not associated by any genetic predisposition with automatic diseases. These are lifestyle intervention factors. It's the hospital and the food and the lack of nutritional awareness of the staff that contributed to these patients going into these nursing homes. From the Journal of the American College of Nutrition, December 1998, an article, Protein Energy Undernutrition and the Risk of Death Within 6 Years of Hospital Discharge. Now, the results of this study showed that protein energy malnutrition is the single strongest predictor of long-term death in elderly individuals discharged from the hospital. The single one. In this study, 322 elderly patients were followed for 6 years after being discharged from the hospital to evaluate the effects that nutritional status had on their long-term survival. Patients were defined as being at risk for malnutrition if they had serum albumin levels below 3.0 deciliters or body mass index below 19. Being at risk for malnutrition was the strongest predictor of death in the following 6 years. A diagnosis of congestive heart failure, being discharged to a healthcare facility, age and marital status were not as strongly associated with mortality as protein energy malnutrition. Well, let's put it into a little different perspective. You have you've tried to make some proper choices. You're now 60, 65, 70. And for whatever condition, you go into a hospital. Once in that hospital, maybe you have an infection that could be treated. But once in that hospital, you end up with a protein energy malnutrition. No other factor in your life will be as important in deciding whether or not you're going to die over the next 6 years as that protein energy malnutrition. Not even heart disease. This comes from the Journal of Parenteral Nutrition, Volume 12. This retrospective study conducted on 771 individuals admitted to two acute care hospitals showed that the rate of likelihood of malnutrition was 59% in medical wards and 48% in surgical wards, with a greater likelihood associated almost a 3.8% increase in death. And suspected malnutrition was also associated with increased length of hospital stay and increased excess average cost of $3,557 per patient. Quote, the impact of a nutritional intervention program could not be assessed because too few patients had received it. So just on an economic level, if you're not getting the care nutritionally in a hospital, you could be spending extra time there and costing about almost $3,500 more. From Health Finance Management, Volume 51, page 66, This article reports on the results of a survey of 19 hospitals indicating that the length of hospital stay decreases by approximately 2 days in patients who receive optimal nutritional care. The survey also revealed that only 7% of patients at risk for malnutrition receive optimal care. And this omission results in an increased cost of $1,064 per patient at risk of malnutrition. That means that they are, let me put it a little different way, that means that they are failing in 19 major hospitals to see that the patient gets proper care in 93% of the time. 93% of the time they are not intervening to help stop that malnutrition, and it's costing the patient $1,064 extra. From the Journal of the American Dietetic Association, this is September 1997, the relationship of nutritional status to length of stay, hospital costs, and discharge status of patients hospitalized in the medical service. This study conducted on all 173 individuals admitted to three medicine units during a one-month period showed that those who, upon admission, were classified as being at risk for malnutrition had, compared to patients not at risk of malnutrition, higher hospital length stays, 6 days versus four, higher hospital costs, $6,196 versus $4,563, and higher home health care needs, even if 91% of them received nutritional intervention during hospitalization. What that's telling me is that a proper nutritional status is not being done adequately as a person is in need of going to the hospital, which tells me that their primary care physician, and those that have primary care physician, is grossly inadequate. So their doctor may be looking at their acute condition, a heart condition, a cancerous condition, a diabetic condition, but they're not looking at their nutritional status. And that is just costing the patient more suffering, more time, more money, and a higher probability of secondary complications. This is an article from the Joint Communal Journal on Quality Improvement, April 1999, a five-year evaluation of malnutrition treatment programs in community hospitals. This study shows that implementation of a malnutrition treatment program in a 395-bed community hospital in Delaware resulted in reduction of average patient length of stay from 10 days to 8 days. And decrease of incidence of major complications from 75% to 17%, and a reduction of third-day hospital readmission rates from 16% to 7%. So what this is really showing is that, hey, if you pay attention to this person's nutritional status, they're going to be out of here quicker, not return as soon, and not have all the complications that then require antibiotic or other medical interventions. The Peer Review Journal, Stroke, Volume 27, page 1028. The article, The Effect of Malnutrition After Acute Stroke on Clinical Outcome. In this study, conducted on a cohort of 104 patients with acute stroke, shows that the number of individuals with malnutrition increased from 16% at admission to 26% after a week in the hospital. Malnourished patients had increased infections and bed sores. In addition, patients with malnutrition after a week of hospitalization had a 350% increased risk of poor outcome, regardless of the age and nutritional status at admission. So let's say that you are a 50-year-old, 60-year-old person and you've had a stroke. Now you go into a hospital. What happens when you get in that hospital is you could be at an increased risk of staying longer, having bed sores. By the way, more people died last year of bed sores in hospitals than in all of our automobile accidents. More people died last year of bed sores than all the soldiers, American soldiers, who died in the entire Vietnam War. That was just last year in 1 year. Bed sores are completely preventable also. And infections. Now, a person gets an infection, and no matter what the source of the infection, the most likely outcome is they're going to get a round of antibiotics. Antibiotics disrupt the immune system, causing further complication. So from all these and other sources, you're malnourished when you go into a hospital and you've had a stroke. You're going to have a poor outcome. From the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Volume 68, page 275. The influence of nutritional status on clinical outcome after acute stroke. This study shows that the nutritional status of patients admitted to the hospital over a 15-month period for acute stroke deteriorated significantly during hospital stay. Malnutrition was significantly associated with increased risk of infections and poor functional outcome, and a strong predictor of death in the 3 months after the stroke. What's it all mean? It means if your stroke won't kill you, the hospital food will. This comes from the Annals of Surgery, Volume 199, page 299. The article, Clinical Significance of Preoperative Nutritional Status in 215 Non-Cancer Patients. The results of this study, conducted on 215 patients hospitalized for surgery, show that those with low nutritional status had a 200% increase rate of post-operative complications and in length of hospital stay compared with those with normal nutritional status. The difference in rate of complications was particularly evident for major complications, which occurred in 31% of undernourished patients compared to 9% for well-nourished patients. What's it mean? It means that if you went in for surgery and you had a low nutritional status, you had a big risk, almost more than double the risk of serious complications, which would cause additional hospitalization. This is from the Proceedings of Nutritional Society, Volume 58. The article is Outcomes of Undernutrition in Patients in the Community with Cancer or Cardiovascular Disease. The results of this study indicate that even low levels of malnutrition are associated with significantly increased rates of death and disability in individuals with cancer or cardiovascular disease. In the study conducted on 10,128 individuals age 18 and older with a diagnosis of cancer or cardiovascular disease, those with body mass index below 20 kilograms per milliliter had higher rates of physician consultations and higher rates of death compared with those levels that were normal. Poor nutritional status was the strongly associated factor with increased risk of hospitalizations in patients with cardiovascular disease. So if you've got cancer, you have heart disease, you go into a hospital, you have a high probability of getting worse and dying, not directly from the cancer, but from the malnutrition. From the Journal of Thoracic and Cardiovascular Surgery, Volume 118, page 866, the article, Impact of Body Mass Index and Albumin on Mortality and Morbidity After Cardiac Surgery. In lay language, quite simply, the results of this study indicate that patients with albumin levels that were low and body mass index that were low undergoing cardiac bypass surgery had significantly higher rates of post-operative morbidity and death compared with those with normal values of both. I'll put a human face on this. It was about 10 years ago that I was having dinner with a family. The wife is a judge, the husband an attorney, and both people certainly are capable of making reasonable judgments. And he informed me at the dinner that he would be going in within the week to have coronary bypass operation. I suggested to him that before he goes in there, to spend a month with me and let me work with him on trying to get him stronger, his immune system stronger, build him up so that he would better be able to not only survive but recover from the surgery. And he said, well, my physician said that I was fine. And I said, but what studies did your physician do on you? None. Just, you know, your basic exam. I said, you cannot look at a person just by their weight and know whether or not they're nutritionally deficient. You can be overfed and undernourished. You could be 200 pounds and still be utterly deficient in magnesium and manganese and potassium and your vitamins. And that's what's important. Don't look at your total body weight. Not that he was overweight, but he was assuming that his doctor knew that he didn't have a problem. So the discussion for the rest of the evening centered on what the doctor knew about nutrition and nutritional status. And my friend's wife was interested in nutrition only secondarily because her daughter had been a friend of mine, and that's how I ended up meeting them and known them for years. But they themselves, they, the husband and wife, really didn't take good care of themselves nutritionally. Their idea was if they didn't have a disease like heart disease or cancer, then they were okay. And even though I asked them repeatedly about just give yourself a little time, even if it's a week, we can do something to build up your immune system. He assured me that his immune system was fine, or his doctor would have said something. So when I saw that I didn't want to belabor the fact and any more than what I had, there are boundaries that we must respect. And when someone finally says, you know, enough, I've made up my mind, I have to pull back and accept that. Well, the next day, he ended up undergoing the knife, and he died later that day after the surgery. And I asked his wife to do an autopsy and check the nutritional status. And she decided not to. Later on, years later, we would have a conversation where she brought up the fact that she had lived with that memory of the argument that they both defended his doctor's capacity to know more about nutrition than I would, and that was my specialty. I'd spent years and years in graduate school and clinical study and board certified and laboratory analysis and clinical laboratory analysis and seeing more patients than any doctor in American history has ever seen for clinical evaluation. Of all $700,000 doctors in America today, no one has seen as many on nutrition as I have. And yet, totally and utterly dismissed my input and suggestions. And then she had to live with the fact that, gee whiz, did they make a mistake? Well, it doesn't do us any good to beat ourselves up on this issue. That's not a point. The point is, what do we learn from it? What's our lesson? Now, there's no way to determine whether or not my input would have prevented that death or not. But if you look at all the studies I'm suggesting, every one of these shows that if your immune system is compromised when you go in for surgery and you're malnourished, you have a much higher risk of dying. And he was malnourished. He was a junk food eater. He was meat and potatoes. And so he didn't take vitamins. So clearly he was malnourished. What was of interest is she became a strict vegetarian, as did the rest of her family. And she devotes a lot of her time, outside of her being a judge, to encouraging people about their nutritional status. It's like her second career to her today. So even with the tragedy of losing someone that you care about, there is an aftermath. Life does go on. And there are some lessons being learned afterwards. And I'm wondering how many people she's encouraged to pay attention to that nutritional status. This comes from Neurology, Volume 53. Nutritional status in a prognostic factor for survival in ALS patients. The results of this study show that patients with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease, with malnutrition have a 770% increased risk of death compared to well-nourished patients, independently of neurological scores and types of ALS. The authors recommend surveillance being increased of nutritional status in patients with this disease, and yet I can tell you from personal experience, as one of my high school buddies who is suffering from advanced stage ALS, when I found out about it and I flew home to West Virginia to talk with him, see if I couldn't help him, he's one of the pillars of our community, and yet no one had ever evaluated him nutritionally. Not a single evaluation nutritionally to know what was going on in his body. So the assumption was, it doesn't make a difference. And this is showing their own journal. Remember, the journal is neurology. And therefore, neurologists, that's their journal. So his neurologist, and he had two, neither one was aware. And that was not the only study from their journals. That's only one I'm giving you. The peer review journal, Chest, Volume 116, page 693. The article, The Impact of Nutritional Status on the Outcome of Lung Volume Reduction Surgery, a Prospective Study. The results of this study indicate that patients with end-stage emphysema and with below normal levels of body mass index undergoing lung surgery have significantly increased post-operative death and length of hospital stay compared to patients with normal levels of body mass index. And this study shows that the body mass index value is a good indicator of nutritional status and a simple way to screen individuals at risk of nutritional deficiencies. The author suggests that correction of nutritional deficiencies may translate to a lower rate of hospital death and length of stay. From the Archives of Medical Research, Volume 30, page 150. Malnutrition in childhood lymphoblastic leukemia, a predictor of early death during the induction to remission phase of the treatment. The results of this study show that malnutrition in children undergoing chemotherapy for acute lymphoblastic leukemia have a 260% increased risk of death compared to well-nourished children. The risk of death increases with increased severity of the nutritional deficiencies. I have counseled many, many parents whose children had lymphoblastic leukemia, were not responding well to treatment. Not once was their nutritional status ever evaluated by their practicing physician. Not one single time. And yet when I would ask these doctors with such arrogance and anger and defiance the questioning of part of their medical practice, my question was simple. I can show you many, many studies from peer-reviewed journals, your own journals, that what you're doing by neglecting that nutritional status of that child is putting them at greater risk of dying. So put your ego on hold. Stop being so defiant of anyone else's input and look at the facts. If the ultimate exercise, if the ultimate goal is to help that child survive, then you've got to pay attention to their nutritional status. But if you ask them what's a nutritional status, they're clueless. The some gross general concept of eating right. No. Eating right could be in part what has caused their death, and I will deal with that I'll deal with that on another part of our series, is the role of diet in causing disease. Next study. This comes from the peer review journal Aging, Volume 11. Disability is associated with malnutrition in institutionalized elderly people. The results of this study indicate that disability in elderly patients is strongly associated with the presence of negative plasma measurements indicative of malnutrition. The association exists independently of age, gender, or presence of coexisting illnesses or other confounding factors. The authors highlight the importance of correcting nutritional imbalances in the management of elderly disabled patients. So what does that tell us? It tells us that a lot of senior citizens are dying who shouldn't have to die when they do, because no one is paying attention to their malnutrition. And it's epidemic in our society. From the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, volume 47, page 1072, the article, Body Mass Index and Mortality, meaning death, among older individuals living in the community. The results of this study show that elderly individuals living in the community who have body mass index below the 22 kilograms, M2, a sign of malnutrition, have a 20% increased risk of dying. For no other reason than that. They're just too thin. They're malnourished. And what does it mean? It means that the immune system does not have the nutrients it needs in order to help these individuals survive, including proper digestion of protein. And many individuals cannot digest the protein that they are normally being fed because of problems with malabsorption syndrome. And therefore, correcting that underlying imbalance would be very important to their outcome. Getting them onto a vegetarian diet where it's easier for them to eat a better digested protein. A fish would be all right, providing it's something like a scrod or orange roughy, an easy-to-digest fish, or grains. Rice is good also. This comes in the British Medical Journal, The Lancet, volume 335, page 1013. The article, Dietary Supplementation in Elderly Patients with Fractured Neck of the Femur. The results of this study show that elderly patients hospitalized with a fracture of the neck of the femur who underwent nutritional supplementation had approximately half the rates of complications and death compared to those who did not receive dietary supplementation. The study was conducted on 59 elderly patients who were randomly assigned to receive daily, for an average of 32 days, in oral nutritional supplements or no supplementation. Most patients had nutritional deficiencies upon admission. Outcome was favorable in 56% of the supplemented patients, compared to only 13% in those who were not supplemented. In the supplemental group, 44% of patients experienced complications or death, compared to 87% of the patients in the non-supplemental group. These differences persisted 6 months after the occurrence of the fracture. Average length of hospital stay was 24 days in the supplemental group, but 40 days in the non-supplemental group. Quote, these findings indicate that daily oral supplementation cuts length of hospital stay and rates of complications by death by half in elderly patients with fractured neck of the femur. Just think of it this way. For the want of a simple vitamin pill, these people are dying. And that's from the British Medical Journal, The Lancet. Also from The Lancet, different article, different issue. Volume 340, page 1127. The effects of vitamin and trace element supplementation on immune responses and infection in elderly patients. The results of this study show that supplementation with modest physiological amounts of nutrients improved immune status and significantly reduced rates of infection in elderly individuals. The study was conducted on 96 healthy elderly patients who were randomized to receive a nutritional supplement containing vitamins and trace elements or a placebo pill. After 12 months, immune function was improved compared to baseline values in individuals who had received nutritional supplementation, but not in those receiving the placebo. In addition, those who received the supplement spent considerably less time being ill from infectious diseases compared to those who did not receive the supplements, 23 days versus 48 days a year. These findings indicate that a single nutritional supplement, a vitamin pill, is effective in improving immune status and significantly decreasing the rates of infections in elderly individuals. And here's the problem. In nursing homes, they don't get the vitamins. Hospitals, they don't get the vitamins. It is grossly overlooked. As a result, senior citizens are dying needlessly. From the British Medical Journal, volume 305, page 927, article, vitamin C depletion and pressure sores in elderly patients with femoral neck fracture. The results of this study show that vitamin C concentration in elderly patients hospitalized with fractured neck of the femur who develop pressure ulcers is approximately half that of patients who did not develop this complication, indicating that vitamin C depletion or deficiency is an important factor in the etiology of pressure ulcers in the elderly. From the Archives of Internal Medicine, Volume 159, page 748.